Hello and welcome to RoundPeg Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Borhani, geostrategy expert with Business Families Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me via Skype from Toronto, Canada today is Devin DeSantis, the managing partner at Landsberg Gersik. We will be discussing their latest portal on COVID-19 and a crisis management toolkit for enterprising families and how to go through something that the world hasn't experienced in the past 100 years at the scale and magnitude that we're all going through together. Devin, welcome to RoundPeg Podcast.
Thank you so much, Ali. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're a fellow Canadian, a fellow Torontonian. That's as much as I share. The rest of your accolades I could not match. You have a master's from Kennedy School at Harvard, focus on finance and economics, a bachelor of business administration from the beautiful York University. But majority of your life and experience has been in and around family businesses, which is very much relevant to the times we're living and the challenges that many family businesses are facing. And some of your insight into this space would be of significant importance. So I want to jump straight into the piece of work and document that your organization has recently released, a crisis management toolkit for enterprising families for COVID-19 era of the world. Can you take us through the nuts and bolts of it very briefly?
Yeah, happy to, Ali. And thank you for sharing this more broadly with your members. This is a resource that we pulled together immediately recognizing that there was felt need among all the families that we see on campus and in our advisory practice who were struggling to make sense of what they were seeing out there in the world, the radical transformation of their operating context, the implications that that has, of course, on ownership and portfolio exposure, as well as liquidity and governance, and of course, all the very personal and real impact that this has on individual family members and on the ability of the family to gather. And as we were gathering these ideas from across our practice and tapping the research that we've been conducting on family-controlled companies who operate in emerging and frontier markets who face this kind of persistent elevated risk for years, decades in some cases, we figured we would share as much as possible of those insights with the community, get it out there quickly, and not let perfection be the enemy in this case, so that folks would have access to at least some resources to begin conversations within their own family enterprise.
And it's a very comprehensive and very timely document. An acronym I came across with was FERM, which is not with I as FERM, but F-E-R-M as Family Enterprise Risk Management Program. What does this program look like? Have you been running it at the firm prior to COVID-19, or is it something that is just being put together because of these crises?
It's a great question. I mean, the best time to prepare for a crisis is, of course, before the crisis strikes and risk spikes in any one of the multiple vectors that are affecting enterprising families out there in the world today. And over the last number of years, I believe almost 5 years now, I've been teaching a module during the Kellogg program on governing family enterprises and another program on board leadership. And we have a session that we conduct, which is specifically focused on risk management, not crisis management, but the thoughtful, planful, institutional approach to managing risk, to tracking risks, to understanding risk appetite and the capacity to bear risk, as well as translating that knowledge, that intelligence into actionable insights for boards, for CEOs, for family councils, and so forth. And so we've been building out an extension of the conventional enterprise risk management framework that emerged out of the last major financial crisis, the global financial crisis of 07 through 09, And really, it came from a regulatory perspective with a high focus on finance, on balance sheet, on operational performance, and on regulatory compliance and reputational risks. But there are, of course, so many more risks that that enterprising families are exposed to outside of the business circle and even within the business circle that weren't being addressed by these frameworks. So we've been working with families to build this out and to create more of a systematic view, a systems level view of risk. And that, of course, then prompts a systems level approach to managing that risk. And so that FERM, or the Family Enterprise Risk Management Framework, I think we've included a couple of slides in the toolkit, teases what that begins to look like and provides a series of questions that boards and families can bring home to begin to explore these concepts.
So one of those slides that you're just referring to, which got my attention among all the others, was that specific touch on risk intelligent. And when you talk about a risk intelligent family council, do family councils have to have a risk committee separate, running in parallel and at all times, or the same family council, one should wear the hat of the chief risk officer for that matter? And what would be the composition of an ideal family council with a risk committee? How many of them you think should be outsiders? How many of them should be family members? And the role of patriarchs, because for instance, for the new gen, this is the first major crisis that they are witnessing in more ways than one. What is the value of wisdom of the patriarch and presence on that committee?
That's a great question, Ali. In fact, we talk about risk intelligence throughout the enterprise, and it's clear to us that each major decision-making entity in some respect is responsible for some key element of activity. In the business, of course, that's the management of operation or operations, a portfolio of companies in some cases, or a one specific entity and ownership. It involves the board as a seat of decision-making authority that is accountable upwards to owners and downwards into the business. And within the family, a family council coordinates the activities of disparate family members, convenes them, educates them, coordinates and collaborates, provides opportunities for them to coordinate and collaborate, but also interfaces with information that's coming out of the enterprise and helps to sort of manage those interactions. It requires leadership around risk management in all of those domains. What we don't see are necessarily sitting committees in the family council around risk. This is really more specifically tailored toward crisis response. And in this case, what we're seeing among many of our, in particular, larger cousin systems, is that the family council is playing a key role in identifying information that can be shared not only from the business to the family, highlighting many of the great works that's taking place among the teams of employees, the approach to managing employees during transition, their approach to customer service, their approach to integrating into a public-private partnership in response to the crisis, and so forth, as celebrating the activity of the business as it's responding to this very real threat to its operating model, and communicating that effectively to family members is something that the family council can nurture and ultimately be a conduit for. It can also nurture information sharing within the family itself. And so you can have all sorts of opportunities for family members to interact. We're seeing webinars get set up around different concepts of education. We're seeing outreach to vulnerable family members, some of the more senior-most members, or some who are more isolated and are used to social interaction. So families are really stepping up to share best practices for co-working and co-locating with spouses who are now also working at home and kids who are learning at home. And we see family members sort of sharing best and worst practices at that. And so the family council can be a great conduit for communicating ideas, highly actionable ideas to families during crises like this.
Well, listen, I know, and you know better than me, that a lot of ultra high net worth individuals and family businesses do not, or used to not to travel together on the same aircraft and change and have a, you know, dispersed program, even if they're going to the same destination. It's funny that how with this crisis, even being in the same house now is a level of heightened risk. So interesting times in expanding that risk calculus. Devin, I would like to ask you about this risk containment, mitigation, management, and in the context of family council. I would assume that it's not just related to family council. If it's not, if I am guessing correctly or wrongly, would that be the type of advisory support work that is set to an outside set of perhaps service providers, advisors, and think tanks, and companies and organizations like yourselves? Is it partly of mixture of Patriarch and the Next Gen? Where is this machine in risk intelligent and risk containment and crisis management sits within the family?
That's a great question, Ali. I think one of the things that we would advocate for is to make sure that we're assigning accountability for each of the key risks appropriately. So once we've identified where we're most exposed, the crisis will inevitably impact each aspect of the enterprise differently, so that we need the governance entity that's best positioned to manage these particular cluster or constellation of issues is adequately empowered, they're adequately resourced, they're properly staffed. And so risks that are specifically related to the business ought to be managed, or the process of managing them ought to be contained within the C-suite. Risks about the entire enterprise, not any individual operating business, but also the exposure to owners, the impact on liquidity, the impact on leverage and banking relationships, and basically the broader risk management framing ought to be coordinated at the board level. And the risk response that the family council can lead is as it specifically relates to individual family members and their ability to gather and communicate effectively during the crisis. And so you want to make sure essentially that you're delegating responsibility and accountability to manage these risks to the entity within the enterprise's governance that's best positioned to handle that. And to your question about the composition, should there be insiders or outsiders? Ultimately, it's easiest to lean on insiders, but to the extent possible, especially in the context of a board of directors, you really want to lean heavily on your independent directors here, because they have eyes and ears out there in the broader business world, assuming they are of a typical profile of an independent board member, and can provide a fresh set of external eyes into the process. And of course, advisory services and companies like ours can come in and help with that as well. But really, you want to tap the talent that you already have around the table, who are already deeply committed to supporting the continuity of the enterprise during this critical moment.
You talk about a lot about goodwill building, and in part of those slides, and you know the way how important it is to develop that goodwill. I asked you about preparation for the risk, and you said it's always better to foresee it coming. How much of the goodwill building during and post-crisis shapes the identity of families? Before, of course, but how many families you know that have turned major crises into an acceleration of their goodwill towards their broader stakeholders, employees, community, and some examples in and around that, if you could share with us?
I think it's a great point, Ali, to challenge enterprising families to acknowledge that they will be measured by their performance during this crisis, during any crisis, in fact. And these are tests of leadership. These are tests of commitment to all of your key stakeholders, and the ways in which organizations respond, not only to their customers, but also to all of their distributors, their suppliers, their team internally, to their owners, and the communication flow that works its way up into the owning family. All of this stuff is being observed And so their actions, their interactions during this moment is something that they ought to be tracking very carefully. In service of that, we've got all sorts of examples throughout history. One that came to mind just in a conversation earlier this morning was a family that we met with in Japan. It goes back over 450 years of continuous family control. And it's a family that was involved in the agricultural sector, and they were responsible at various points over the last several centuries at supporting the communities in which they operated during times of famine, for instance. So when there was a large crop failure and they had reserves of rice and other key ingredients that went into the goods that they were producing for most of Japan at that point, they dipped into those stockpiles and they were there to support the communities within which they were embedded, the communities that they depended on for their livelihood in better times. And you can see there are sort of entire documents describing the town's eternal gratitude to these enterprising families in this moment of need. And this is a great opportunity for families to acknowledge that, yes, while they're wrestling with crisis and while they're dealing with battening down the hatches and just trying to secure the survival of their own enterprise, the silver lining of any crisis is, of course, not only that one can search for and is forced to search for alternative modes of sustaining oneself, of building resilience into the enterprise, but also can engage with external stakeholders in a way that builds a tremendous amount of goodwill that can be drawn down after the crisis and harnessed to the best interests of the enterprise.
Couldn't agree more, Devin. Yesterday on a BBC program, they were talking about some of the landlords, a few cases in which they have asked elderly landlords to ask the NHS workers to leave there and served, a notice for them to leave their premises because they felt that, you know, they're high risk and having an NHS worker is another high risk in lodging agreements in UK. And I was thinking with myself that this would be a prime time for some of the family-owned, service departments or hotels to open their doors and to receive people and, you know, to let their assets to be used for good reason and good purpose. I wanted to ask you about the point you raised in ownership. And is there a massive deal flow in times like this in which, because of pressures on publicly listed companies and family businesses would come and acquire assets? Is there a trend and a curve in crisis that the ownership has changed from publicly listed companies that go through stress to family businesses?
What we certainly see in the data, as well as in our practice, is that because family enterprises are conventionally more conservative in the management of their balance sheet, they tend to perhaps underperform in the upcycle, but tend to outperform considerably in the downcycle. And therefore, over the long run and the ups and downs of the cyclicality of valuations and economic output in general, that family enterprises tend to outperform. That said, in the down cycle, because they tend to be more conservative in the management of their balance sheet, tend to use less leverage or debt, and tend to have more cash reserves on hand, they're able to deploy that war chest as asset values are collapsing very advantageously. And we saw a lot of that opportunistic acquisition coming out of the financial crisis over a decade ago, and suspect that we will see more of that consolidation here as well. It's also worth mentioning, and this is a follow-on point to the repurposing of capital that you just mentioned, Ellie, and that is that we've seen not only in ancient Japan family-controlled companies contributing to support the communities within which they're embedded, but you're in the modern context seeing distilleries and fashion companies repurposing their manufacturing capacity to make hand sanitizer. You're seeing hotels, as you described, repurpose their vacant rooms at this point with some augmentation from also family-controlled building and development companies to upgrade these rooms so that they can actually be overflow rooms, overflow capacity for overstretched hospitals, in particularly in large urban centers where the crisis is overwhelming the healthcare system as it exists. And we're seeing all sorts of innovation happening around masks of various sorts and innovations that are trying to accelerate the production of ventilators, accelerate the production of masks and other surgical PPE equipment that can support frontline healthcare workers as well as the population more generally. So we try to flatten the curve here and slow the spread of something that will continue to slosh around out there until, as a species, we develop a herd immunity or a vaccine emerges. And either of those outcomes is still sort of 12 to 18 months out. So all of the initiatives that families are able to deploy in the near to midterm to help mitigate some of the worst risks, the worst impacts of this crisis is very welcome indeed and worth celebrating. We're trying to actually gather a bunch of examples of that to help energize families, to help them sort of shake out of the guilt that they have and the anxiety that they have as a result of experiencing this crisis, and begin to reframe their planning horizon out beyond, and to think about how they can turn some of this tragedy into an opportunity, either for themselves or to support the communities within which they are most closely embedded.
How much do you think of that, is not only associated with the balance sheets and times and, you know, the fiscal health, but also in decision-making process? Because one of the biggest issues right now for a lot of publicly listed companies are AGMs and dividend approvals or the reviews, and everybody's finding that they're very ill-prepared for not being able to have the protocols in which they could have these AGMs or approvals in a publicly listed setting in motion under crisis like this. But within a family, one would think that some of these decisions are taken much quicker, much more agile, and, you know, and without major hiccups. Is that part of to their toolkit as an advantage as well, you think?
Speed is certainly an advantage here, and the capacity, at least for those that are privately held, to be able to design any accountability or governance framework that best suits the enterprise is a huge benefit. That said, we also see the most progressive and families that we interact with taking some of the best practices of publicly traded governance and the regulatory environment and framework that imposes on them and nurture that. And whether that means transparency of information flow, whether it's around the way in which financials are gathered and so forth, all of that is it's supportive of their approach to responding to these crises rapidly, but with the rigor of the public markets.
So, Devin, on this decision making speed, in many families, you will see the next gen who are all impact oriented, social impact, entrepreneurs in more ways than one. And you may have a body of the family that is more of wisdom and experience and having seen one too many crises before the new generation. How will these two worlds emerge in times of crisis in terms of decision making within families?
Well, in times of crisis, one thing that we see is the planning horizon comes way in. So where previously families might have been thinking in quarter century terms, the horizon can be as soon as days, if not weeks, depending on the business in which you're currently operating. We've got clients who are or in the hospitality business or in the travel and transportation business right now, who've effectively gone from fully functioning enterprises to a complete standstill. And that is an existential threat to them. And so their planning horizon shrinks way in. That said, hopefully, they've had experiences with this in the past and have learned from those experiences, have a nest egg that they've been maintaining outside of the family enterprise, have relationships with banking partners that can support bridge financing and so forth, or joint venture partners who have the patience and the capacity to inject more capital, rescue capital, one might argue, into the enterprise to sustain it during this complex time and begin to reposition it rather than hollow it out and harvest it. for scraps, but to actually reposition it for success if and when the crisis ultimately recedes.
Do you think in terms of the adaptability and the flexibility that families require in absorbing knowledge and receiving knowledge, the role of organization like yourself, like Landsberg-Gersig or Business Families Foundation, does that pick up during the crisis, or you're normally called for the morning after, like, you know, watching a car crash in slow motion, like these auto test centers in Mercedes or Porsche when they show? How much of that happens before, during, and after crisis?
Well, given our focus and our framing around risk management and family enterprise risk management, we've been advocating for quite some time that families ought to be proactive about thinking about these kinds of risks and putting into place, if nothing else, a fire drill, a script that families can follow in the event of an emergency. You break the glass and these are the first three people that need to sit in a room and decide what happens next. Here's where all the access to the information is. Here's how we'll gather it. Here's how we'll disseminate it. Here's who we need involved in responding and triage and so forth. All of that stuff can be articulated before a crisis hits. And at that point, you can sort of open up the playbook and say, well, you know, we can take 70% of this, but we still need to improvise. That's fine. But at least you're building from a shared agreement to how the enterprise will respond to the crisis. For those families that are sort of facing this unprepared, you can still follow the same playbook, but you sort of have to build the plane while flying it. And that involves making sure you convene the right crisis response team. It means asking the right questions about the risks that the company, the enterprise is truly facing and systematically facing, and whether or not any of those risks can cascade from one domain into the other. So you really do need a view from 30,000 feet, but you need to gather the data right from the ground. And so it is quite a heavy lift, and not something you'd like to have to build in the middle of a storm, but it is a necessity that families be deliberate about how they are responding to this crisis and document as much as possible what they're doing and how what the outcomes of are those actions, what the outcomes of those actions are, so that when they're faced with a similar situation at some point, inevitably in the future, it might not be this same risk that flares up, it might not be a pandemic, but inevitably there will be another financial crisis at some point. That's just the nature of open markets. Inevitably there will be some other geopolitical risk that emerges. Inevitably there will be a supply chain risk or a risk that happens that's particular to the business itself. But in that moment, you'll at least have a playbook that you can rely on, some institutional memory that not only this is how we dealt with the risk and this is what worked and didn't, but eventually we got through it and there were brighter days ahead. And that sense of hope is also very critical as families are engaging in these conversations right now, where it seems like there isn't yet a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's very interesting. Do you find a lot of families or some or the leading families going into a post-mortem after crisis and say how we deal with it, or they have to catch up with everything that has been lost in terms of value creation, business, and catching up with the market momentum? How many of them really spend and even after a crisis go into a deep dive and to say, while we're still close to it, let's see what's happening. Let's see how prepared we were, how unprepared we were, what has been the toll mentally and emotionally, because this would cause a lot of, I guess, stress on family bodies' well-being as well, and not just a balance sheet. Is that something that you see among your clients, members, or how is that panning out?
One response, a very natural response to any crisis like this that emerges is some reflection, a postmortem of some sort. And that's pretty common. I mean, something tragic just happened. Let's understand the origins of it. Let's understand the impact of it. Let's understand our response and assess that response in some way. That tends to happen in most of the systems that we're involved in, where we see a distribution responses is in fact what happens next. So what do you do with that information? What do you do with that experience? Do you formally document it? Do you build in the wake of the Great Recession a risk and audit committee that is specifically empowered to track a map of risks? Do we build an enterprise risk management dashboard that tracks these risks in real time? Do we make risk management and risk planning a critical function of the board, in fact, that we think about the business as being chasing the upside and pursuing all of the opportunities that are in front of the enterprise in a variety of ways, and that it's the board's responsibility to be tracking the risks to that strategic plan and so forth? So how institutionalized is the risk management response in the wake of a big wake-up call like this, as the Great Recession was and as this pandemic clearly is? I suspect, given the structural impact of this, even more so than just a financial crisis, this is truly affecting the real economy in a way that is catastrophic for entire industries, let alone individual companies, that there's going to be a much easier conversation, certainly on our part, and talking about how important it is to build a family enterprise risk management program as you're coming out of this crisis to help manage any future risks that might flare up in the future.
I'm sure you'll be very busy after these crises. And that's going to take me to Asia Pacific, which have witnessed some of these pandemics a little bit closer, MERS, SARS, etc., in a more accentuated way than this one going around the world. Have you experienced a much more better preparedness in their neck of the woods when it comes to crisis management and risk management because of those past experiences? Or do you think that, no, not necessarily, because the magnitude is much more different this time, and because maybe the world is much more interconnected, more supply chains are much more interconnected, capital markets are much more interconnected?
Sure. One of the things that we see in Asia Pacific in particular, those countries, the small sort of island economies, as they would be described, the Taiwans, the Singapores, the Hong Kongs, that are city states ultimately, that had a profound experience with SARS in particular, and built into public policy, into public health initiatives, entire organizations that were mobilized very quickly, very early on in this crisis, to coordinate the structural response, not only in terms of guidance for individuals, in terms of the apps that were used to track, in terms of the policies and the fees and the hospitals and all the protocols, in terms of procurement of all the critical goods that are necessary to treat a viral infection like this. And so all of that infrastructure was essentially the groundwork for that was laid in past crises. And the fact that they happened recently, that their experience with a structurally disruptive epidemic, an outbreak, is so important, because the last time that most of the rest of the world truly grappled with a viral outbreak like this was 100 years ago. And so, as with the financial memory, the sort of memory for this kind of social disruption is quite short. And so it's important to acknowledge that the places that appear to have been managing this most effectively from a governance perspective, both in public policy circles as well as in terms of private enterprise, has been, places like Taiwan and Singapore, for sure. And South Korea would be, I think, included in that group as well.
What are your views on how China responded to the crisis? Your personal perspective on the way that China handled these crises. When you count those island states and city states, you counted Hong Kong, Singapore, you left China out. And I'm curious to know, what are your thoughts there?
I think China is always such a unique example of a country that has, because of its authoritarian structure, the ability to move swiftly, much like privately held family-controlled companies. That's an asset when you're dealing with a crisis to be able to move so swiftly. But it also, okay. I always get overwhelmed in thinking about just the sheer number of individuals that the Chinese government is accountable for, is ultimately responsible for. And so, you know, whether or not we're receiving accurate data coming out of China about infections or deaths and so forth, it's difficult to argue with how quickly the state was mobilized in order to lock this down. And there are, of course, cultural components to that as well, insofar as certain cultures are more amenable to government imposition of emergency measures around the movement of individuals freely in society and so forth. I was on a call earlier with a dear colleague in Sweden where she was mentioning that there isn't even a provision within the Swedish constitution to allow for a federal, a sort of a national level lockdown or stay in place order. So you can tell that the culture and the natural governance model of the state will deeply impact the speed with which and the comprehensiveness with which they're able to respond.
Now, I want to take a shift into the very interesting wheel that you have put in one of your slides: ownership continuity, business continuity, and family continuity. And at the center is dream alignment. So expand a bit on the alignment of dreams and how would that work? I know that that's like an... protected with human capital as an airbag around it. But take us a bit into that world of dream alignment between these three components.
One of the things that we've seen, and we've included this here just in general, because when you think about continuity planning, right, you sort of building resilience into an enterprise so it can endure for the long run, that tends to be something that happens from a position of stability. When we have the time and the resources available to pause in the midst of otherwise successful operation to say, where are we going and what do we aspire to for the business among our ownership and how we coordinate and how we want to live and integrate and collaborate as a family. And so having a common vision for the future of the enterprise is vital. What we see during crises is that the ability to stare out that far and to imagine a future 10, 15, 25 years out when it's difficult to imagine being a going concern even 6 months out, what essentially happens is we get forced a few rungs down Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and where we're no longer thinking about self-actualization or organizational purpose, we're really forced to focus on survival. And so while this idea of a shared vision or a shared dream for the enterprise is something that can energize and help orient decision making throughout the organization if it's clearly articulated and commonly felt among the owning family, in moments like this, you don't hear of those kinds of conversations taking place. Right now, we're more feeling the existential threat of a permanently disrupted operating environment, forcing us to think about, you know, complex trade-offs, like do we keep our employees on the payroll, or do we furlough them, or do we lay them off? Should our senior management team take a pay cut? Should the investing family, the owning family, reinvest some of their personal savings in order to sustain and support the business during this complex time? You know, these are the kinds of questions and dilemmas that they're faced with, which aren't so much a shared dream as in some ways avoiding a shared nightmare. And so they're really managing the downside versus finding energy and chasing the upside. And it's really vital that when moments of calm return, even during a crisis, there will be moments of calm. And when you get to the position where you're no longer in panic mode and you can begin to think about rebuilding, begin to think not only about how we can reconfigure to endure until conditions normalize, but also what opportunities might be present for us in the market as we emerge from this. You know, will it leave us stronger than when we entered this? Are we an anti-fragile organization, as an Nassim Taleb would suggest, you know, something that actually is strengthened in crisis and gets stronger by being challenged and tested by the marketplace and by the environment in which it's operating. And that's where next-gen voice can be particularly powerful. All of those initiatives, all the thinking about the future of work and climate crisis and climate change and all of the repositioning around long-term goals, well, all of a sudden they become more acute in some of these issues once we get the stability to think, well, maybe there is some way of innovating our business model. Maybe, you know, where previously we thought that virtual convening was impossible, now we recognize that, you know, when it's necessary, we've found ways of integrating it into our workflow. So how far does the workforce snap back into that previous way of organizing? And what are the implications for commercial real estate, for urban planning, for, you know, for engagement and empowerment, for sourcing talent, for making investments in diversification if all asset classes are moving together in crises like this? There are all sorts of knock-on questions that families can begin grappling with, but only once they've paused and come to a level of acceptance that this crisis isn't going away anytime soon, and they need a plan for the near to midterm in terms of enduring a coping strategy, as it were, while risk will be elevated, will remain elevated for the next, we'll call it 6 to 18 months, but also begin to plan optimistically for the future and begin to plant the seeds around which hopefully future opportunities will spring.
Well, every time till a few years ago when I was around with my old grandfather who passed away at the age of 96, I always felt the older generation are a bit more, how do you say, solid, more resilient, more more hardened. Is that something that is resonated in family businesses as well? You always think that your grandfather and your father may have gone through much more than us in that moment of time. Or the new generation is really ready for some of these risks and challenges and complexities. I always felt that, you know, the backbone of the family was much more stronger than the new versions of the cars. It's like the old Cadillacs, much heavier, of course, but much more as well in a sense sturdy. Is that something that you feel in families in different generations or not necessarily?
I think it's a fantastic question, Ali, and it's difficult to make a generalization about this, but I will say this, that we do identify a couple of themes, some of which are a little counterintuitive. When we began our research into families who operate in emerging and frontier markets, one of the things we asked ourselves and asked the families that we were interviewing as part of this global research project was, you know, what was the risk appetite of the senior generation relative to the next generation? And in developed markets, what we found is that in general, of course, we don't want to say this is with certainty every senior gen is of this mentality, but in general tended to be more conservative in their outlook towards investment and risk management. And the next generation tended to have a greater appetite for risk. We think of this in the construct of appetite for risk. And that plays out in the research literature. There's sort of countless studies of how age can impact your risk preferences and your risk appetite over time. One of the counterintuitive things, though, that we found in emerging and frontier markets was an inversion of that condition, such that it was more often the senior family members who had the thicker skin, who'd been operators in complex environments for decades and had dealt with questions of graft and issues of economic dislocation, hyperinflation, access to foreign exchange that can dry up at a moment's notice during a currency crisis and so forth. And they become quite hardened. They become, you know, really adept at taking risks and managing elevated risk in these environments. And oftentimes we would see next generation family members who get sent away to school, often because it's both more safe and because there's a greater trust in the educational systems in places like the UK and the US. And then those next gen family members return to their family companies in emerging and frontier markets, oriented to a Western style of business management and leadership, and sometimes struggle to reintegrate and feel that their families are taking a tremendous amount of risk operating in these environments. Why would we continue to operate in Syria or Yemen or Venezuela, or Iraq during an open crisis or during a civil war, for instance? And the argument among the senior generation is often, well, if we don't do it, then who will? Who will step up in order to support the communities that we've been supporting with our goods and services for, in some cases, over 100 years? And so it's an amazing question to ask. I don't think there's any empirical data that suggests that all systems will follow a particular trend. But this was one really unique counterintuitive insight that came from our research, which we didn't expect coming in.
It's a fascinating finding. I am really taken away by it, that inversion that you were talking about. In the same document, you have talked about some of the light at the end of the tunnel and opportunities in medical services and devices, e-commerce, online entertainment, online education, telecommuting. Do you think that within this context and world of opportunities, we will see potentially massive consolidations in which families would be at the center of some of these actions? Or do you think that this is the new gens, basically more domain, a lot of it is technology related? Or do you think as well we may see a complete shift back to basics? Because one of the discussions right now is that this crisis has highlighted the importance of simplicity, of community, of back to the roots, basically. Where do you think these opportunities merging and coming together, that much of tech pivot versus that inversion at the global level, not just through supply chains, but values and the rest of it?
In general, we like to think about sort of emergent opportunities that can come from a crisis like this. One of that clearly is resonating across the sort of the management consultancies, the design firms, the commercial real estate industry is the future of work. And you could probably search the internet and find 100 webinars in any given day trying to describe how work will be conducted, what the office of the future will look like. In fact, there have been people speculating about this via various technologies, various manufacturing techniques, AI, robotics, 3D printing, and so forth, that may radically transform where things get made, how they get made, how they get distributed, and how the people who make those decisions convene in order to make those decisions. And so what I think this crisis has done, if anything, is pulled the future forward a little bit. And where previously we might have thought that the kind of virtual convening that folks are experimenting with now was still 10 years out. We're talking about augmented reality sort of board meetings where people are not flying in from halfway around the world and creating a massive carbon footprint, but in fact putting on a headset and convening virtually around a common boardroom here with the sense that in fact you are physically present in the room with others, because that we acknowledge is so important, reading up subtle body cues and so forth. But this is what people have been, science fiction writers have certainly spilled a lot of ink on this, but a lot of technologists are emerged and engaged in this too. And we have a wonderful relationship with Singularity University where they do a lot of thinking about this stuff. And I suspect that you're going to begin to see, as families try to look for opportunities out in the future, they need to begin to build up their awareness of some of the meta trends that are shaping society. And whether that's around advanced technology on the biotech side or on the AI side in robotics or on 3D printing and manufacturing or on around life sciences, or if it's just around how human beings will convene and interact You know, these trends ought to have huge implications for the value of commercial real estate, of urban real estate, of transportation systems, of supply chains. The shift toward more of a mercantilist mindset has that sense that we ought to be making everything in our country. So when we need masks, we don't have to rely on another country to do this, and so forth. So there are a whole bunch of public policy changes that are likely to come. There's a bunch of onshoring that might be a big movement here. Whether that's long-term healthy for the global economy is something that economists, I'm sure, will be debating for years to come. But families need to begin to test out some of these hypotheses and gather data about some of these trends and build into their board meetings opportunities to begin to think about the long-term structural implications of the future of work and the future of cities on their business models.
I would like to thank you, Devin, for joining us today on RoundPeg Podcast. And I am very much hoping that we could have a post-COVID-19 session to take a look at some of these topics we covered today. And hopefully the world will come out of this stronger, more coherent, and for better days ahead.
I very much look forward to it, Ali. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
You've been listening to RoundPeg Podcast, brought to you by Business Families Foundation and 360 Strategic Advisors. We hope you really liked what you heard today. You can always subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or other platforms to hear the next conversation and our new episodes as soon as they become available.